From Feature Story News in Washington and our bureaus around the world, this is FSN Reports. I'm Kevin McAleese. On today's programme, President Obama's State of the Union address comes into focus. Our correspondent on the Hill has the details.
The President was elected President of the United States, not King of the United States. He cannot unilaterally fix this broken immigration system. He needs the Congress to act.
While the security concerns swirl the Sochi Winter Games, we look at the social and environmental impacts of the Olympics. We're in Brazil to hear about a new project transforming Rio's urban areas. And we reflect on the eight-decade-long career of folk music legend and activist Pete Seeger.
Normally, I'm against big things. I think the world's going to be saved by millions of small things.
That's coming up on FSN Reports after our latest summary of the day's headlines.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Lorna Shaddick. President Barack Obama makes his annual State of the Union address in Washington, D.C. on Tuesday night. The speech to a joint session of Congress is expected to focus on economic inequality in America and the president's plans to fix it. The White House says he'll raise the minimum wage level paid to new federal government contractors in a bid to jumpstart anti-poverty moves. Our Washington correspondent Simon Marks has the details.
On the face of it, this is a bold move by President Obama. He's signing an executive order raising the minimum wage for new federal government contractors, including janitors, construction workers, and a host of others, from $7.25 an hour to $10.10 an hour. It's a bid to seize the initiative from Congress, which has been dragging its feet over raising the minimum wage. But the president's executive order, by definition, can only impact a relatively small number of American workers, and he'll make the case for a much larger move to improve the minimum wage in his State of the Union address.
The Prime Minister and Cabinet of Ukraine have resigned amid continuing anti-government demonstrations. Prime Minister Azarov was deeply unpopular with the opposition, who said he mismanaged the economy and failed to tackle corruption. The resignation came as the country's parliament voted overwhelmingly by 361 votes to 2 to scrap recently passed anti-protest laws that led to clashes between police and protesters. The protests have spread in recent days across Ukraine, even to President Yanukovych's stronghold in the east. Well, that ongoing crisis in Ukraine was one of the items on the agenda in Brussels, where a summit between the European Union and Russia got underway on Tuesday. Both neighbours accused the other of meddling in Ukrainian internal affairs, but Russia's President Vladimir Putin denied Moscow was interfering, saying it's merely looking after its own economic interests.
As to the issue of Ukraine's signing the association agreement with the EU, the concern here is not the sovereign choice of the Ukraine, but the economic impact of that agreement. And we had a detailed discussion with our colleagues today. Could this exist in the free trade zone that Ukraine is in right now? In fact, the zone was originally promoted by the Ukraine. We would most likely fail to preserve the current preferential regime for the Ukraine if it signed the association agreement.
The trial has begun in Egypt of former Islamist President Mohamed Morsi, who's charged with escaping from prison in 2011. Mr. Morsi shouted that he is still the country's legitimate leader. He was deposed by the military last July and now faces four separate criminal charges. From bureaus worldwide, this is FSN. Two of the most powerful men from the Bosnian War of the 1990s are in court on trial for war crimes. Former Bosnian Serb leader Radovan Karadzic called on his ex-deputy Ratko Mladic to give evidence at the tribunal in The Hague, but Mr. Mladic has refused. Jack Parrock reports.
Radovan Karadzic and Ratko Mladic, the highest-ranking Bosnian Serb officials from the Bosnian War, have appeared together in public for the first time since the conflict ended in 1995. Mr. Karadzic, who faces 11 charges, including genocide, has called on Mr. Mladic, who is his deputy and head of the military, to testify that he hadn't been the one to order the killing of over 7,500 Muslims in the infamous Srebrenica massacre. Both men are being tried simultaneously at the International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia being held in The Hague, but haven't been in the same room until now. They continue to deny war crimes and crimes against humanity for their part in the three-year Bosnian conflict.
Pete Seeger has died of natural causes at the age of 94. The noted American folk singer was a member of the American Communist Party and even indicted by the US Congress. Here's Priscilla Huff.
I had a song, I'd sing it in the morning.
My job is to show folks there's a lot of good music in this world, said Pete Seeger in his 90th year. And he was convinced that music, if used right, might help save the planet.
Do everything, turn, turn, turn.
During his brief stint as a student at Harvard University, Pete Seeger joined the Young Communist League, a decision that would haunt him even though he quit the group. Nearly 20 years later, after building a career researching, writing, and performing folk music with groups such as the Weavers, he was indicted on 10 counts of contempt of the U.S. Congress for refusing to answer questions about his political beliefs and his voting record. A prison sentence of 1 year was later overturned, and he continued to focus on his music.
That's the latest Feature Story News. Lorna Shaddick reporting.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Kevin McAleese. Welcome to FSN Reports. Just hours ahead of his State of the Union address, President Obama signed an executive order to raise the minimum wage for federal contractors to $10.10 an hour. The order, which came after months of protests by low-wage contractors in DC and around the country, will only apply to new contracts and won't begin until 2015. But the president plans to call tonight for Congress to raise the minimum wage for all workers, one of many expected policy demands aimed at recapturing the support of the progressives who put him in office. Those progressives, some of whom came to Capitol Hill to protest Tuesday, say they want to see more concrete actions from the president on everything from immigration to climate change. Our correspondent Alice Olstein has more.
President Obama!
President Obama!
What you gonna do?
What you gonna do?
You gonna stop this pipeline?
Stop this pipeline!
Stop this pipeline!
On the morning of the president's State of the Union address, activists marched around the Capitol, demanding the president use his speech to officially reject the federal permit for the Keystone XL pipeline, which would transport tar sands oil from Canada to the Gulf Coast. Chanel Blackwell with the environmental group 350.org said the action aimed to provide a counterpoint to the big push from corporations and many members of Congress to secure the pipeline's approval.
He's getting pressure, you know, to say yes and approve the pipeline, but we think, no, you stand now and let your legacy be as a climate champion and not, you know, as the president who allowed the pipeline and allowed all these other things, you know, to follow. What we want him to do is understand that literally the human race depends on him making a responsible decision with KXL. KXL could set a very dangerous precedent if he doesn't shut it down now.
The president's speech Tuesday night is rumored to be heavily focused on what he can and will do without cooperation from Congress. This new effort aims to build on executive actions he's already taken as president, including measures to protect undocumented students from deportation, to curtail pollution from power plants, and most recently, to raise the minimum wage for federal contractors. Some lawmakers, including Vermont independent Bernie Sanders, are applauding the federal wage hike, saying it's a good first step toward addressing widespread poverty and inequality in the U.S.
It will raise wages for several hundred thousand low-wage workers in this country now who are paid for by taxpayers' dollars through federal contracts. And I think the taxpayers of this country want to know that their money is not going to pay people starvation wages. Second of all, I think it gives us momentum. It gives us momentum in the fight to raise the minimum wage for every American worker so that nobody in this country works for less than $10.10 an hour.
A study by the National Employment Law Project found that one in five low-wage federal contractors depend on Medicaid for health care, and 14% use food stamps. Over the past year, some of these workers have staged walkouts, strikes, and protests in D.C. and other cities, calling on the president to use his power to raise their wages. But some on Capitol Hill, including Kentucky Republican Rand Paul, say they're troubled by this further shift toward executive actions and away from engagement across party lines.
You know, I think one of the basic precepts of our government was the division of power, separation of powers. We had checks and balances. So I have a real problem with it. you know, legislation takes hard work. He needs to come down here, talk to people, find allies on the opposite side. And I think the real true test of a leader is somebody who can come and will come. Bypassing, you know, Congress is really, I think, showing a lack of leadership and a lack of courage.
Another theme of President Obama's speech will be immigration reform, which stalled this year even after the Senate passed a bipartisan, comprehensive bill. The president has invited undocumented activist Cristian Avila to sit in his box during the State of the Union address. Avila was one of several who fasted for nearly 3 weeks in a tent outside the Capitol in November and December to demand Congress quickly provide a path to citizenship for the more than 11 million undocumented people currently in the U.S. Another faster and immigration activist is Eliseo Medina with the Service Employees International Union. He said this week that he's hoping for both Congress and President Obama to push for real reform in 2014.
The president has been crystal clear that he's for immigration reform. However, we understand that the president was elected president of the United States, not king of the United States. So consequently, he cannot unilaterally fix this broken immigration system. He needs the Congress to act. He does have the authority, as he did with the Dreamers, to provide some measure of relief. But having said that, the president is absolutely right. This cannot be fixed by him alone. It needs Congress to act so that we can have a solution for the long term, not just for the short term.
Looking forward to this fall's midterm elections, in which Latino voters could have a major say in who controls the House and the Senate, Republicans are expected to unveil a blueprint for immigration reform later this week. In Washington, I'm Alice Olstein.
This is FSN Reports. Folk legend Peter Seeger has died at the age of 94 in New York.
To everything, turn, turn, turn. There is a season, turn, turn, turn. And a time to every purpose under heaven. A time to be born, a time to die. A time to plant, a time to reap. A time to kill, a time to heal, a time to laugh, a time to weep.
A musician, activist, and environmentalist, his career spanned 8 decades. His music and social activism were tightly interwoven, whether it was fighting for civil rights alongside Martin Luther King, protesting the Vietnam War, or when in his 90s marching alongside Occupy Wall Street demonstrators. And as recently as November, he wrote to Russian President Vladimir Putin, requesting the release of the Greenpeace Arctic 30. In a statement, President Obama said Seeger used his voice and his hammer to strike blows for workers' rights and civil rights, world peace and environmental conservation. To look at the life and legacy of the folk legend, I spoke to Pete Seeger biographer Alan Winkler.
Simply would stop up in Beacon, New York, or talk to him on the phone every month or so for half an hour. Played music with him, took a class of my Miami University students to visit him in Beacon one day. We flew in and out of LaGuardia from Ohio in one day, but it was a marvelous day. I've taken friends up to just sit in his living room and play music on a couple of banjos and a couple of acoustic guitars, and it's been a wonderful experience. And he's been very generous to me, he and his wife Toshi both.
This is a man who over the last 8 decades has been a performer, a campaigner, a tireless activist, a man who has received tributes today far and wide from the President of the United States himself down.
I've always thought that basically his life reflects every major important social trend in the 20th century. In other words, he was somebody who was passionate in favor of union organization and the working man, and sang songs to that effect in the 1930s. He was somebody who believed in civil rights with every fiber of his body, and it was he who rewrote the song that became We Shall Overcome and became the anthem of the civil rights movement. He used his music to challenge American policy in Vietnam in the 1960s. And he became part of the environmental movement when he saw sludge and all kinds of awful things floating in the Hudson River very close to where he lived. And that led him to raise money to build a sloop called the Clearwater, which popularized environmental issues just as the movement was beginning to get started at the end of the 20th century and on into the 21st.
But well into his 90s, as he was still very active in his campaigning, and in fact joined the Occupy Wall Street movement,
marched with them. Yes, he did.
And as recently as November, we understand he also wrote a letter to Russian President Vladimir Putin, calling on the release of the Greenpeace Arctic protesters.
He was interested in everything. He read widely, magazines, books. It was wonderful for him to say, oh, you know, I remember something I read, and then pull out an article or refer me to a book, which I usually track down, and he was usually right on the mark. He could be optimistic at times, pessimistic about climate control and change and the like, but still reflecting on and engaging on all of those things, and it was a real pleasure.
In terms of his music, what do you think will stand the test of time?
There are just dozens, if not hundreds, of songs that are still being sung that are his songs. I just had a guitar lesson. We were playing Seeger songs, so we played things like If I Had a Hammer, or Where Have All the Flowers Gone, or Turn, 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 and then a whole host of others. And these are things that you can sing along, that they're melodies that you hold with you. And he was just so wonderful at getting audiences to sing with him, and that made a huge difference.
But there were some dark periods as well. In the 50s and 60s, he found himself blacklisted by the U.S. government.
He was a radical. He was a member of the Young Communist League for about 4 years. He never changed those attitudes, even though he ceased being a formal member of the party. But then he was tarred in awful ways during the McCarthy period in the 1950s. And it almost ended his career, but he pushed on. And by singing, because he could not get dates at the large venues, but by singing in colleges, universities, labor union halls and the like, summer camps, he developed a kind of following that opened the way up to the rebirth of the folk music movement. And for that, he deserves endless credit. I mean, he was the mentor for Joan Baez, Peter, Paul and Mary, Bob Dylan, Tom Paxton, Phil Oakes, and the list goes on and on and on. And he was really a great human being in a very quiet, unassuming way.
Pete Seeger biographer Alan Winkler. This is FSN Reports.
It is a great honor for me to address you today and to present the bid of Sochi to host the Olympic Winter Games in 2014. The bid has enthusiastic support of the whole of Russia. We pledge to make the stay of Olympians and Paralympians, spectators, journalists, guests in Sochi, a safe, enjoyable, and memorable experience.
President Vladimir Putin addressing the International Olympic Committee ahead of Russia's winning bid to host this year's Games. Now, with just days to go until the Sochi Winter Olympics begin, the event is being dogged by corruption estimates, anti-homosexual legislation, and topping the list, security fears. As American athletes arrive in the southern resort city, Olympic and US State Department advisories have emphasised how seriously security threats are being taken. Earlier, I spoke to journalist and author Mackenzie Funk about his recent visit to Sochi and what issues, in his opinion, are being overlooked.
Yeah, well, I think there are two. Of course, there's a lot being talked about with the security issues and gay rights and other things. I think the two things that are underreported and very important to understand about Sochi are, one, that this was not always Russian territory, and there are a lot of ethnic tensions based on that that are now bubbling up, or at least related to those early ethnic tensions, and two, that it was a very pristine natural area, and they had to build everything from scratch, which has made locals, some of them environmentalists, some of them just local residents, very unhappy. And those are the two main things I focused on. I should say the environmental aspects and the activists themselves, most of all.
Well, let's talk just briefly about the fact that this is a restive region. The close proximity to Chechnya, as I think you write, only seems to have dawned on people in the last few months. You know, this has always been an issue.
Yeah, it's quite strange. You know, I became interested in the region well in advance of the Olympics, mainly because there had been a bombing at the cable car at Mount Elbrus, and that's the highest peak in all of Europe, which is just to the east of Sochi, you know, a few hundred miles, I believe. And it's, you know, some separatists or extremists of some sort had bombed the cable car there. No one was injured, but also some Russian tourists had been killed by gunmen a few days before that. And so that was what got me looking at the area. And, of course, I went to Sochi now a year ago, knowing all that background. There are lots of different ethnic groups there that have been there for generations, for centuries. It's important to distinguish those who are extremists and those who are simply there and unhappy about the games and the way they've been treated by Russia for many reasons. The jihadi elements have become radicalized since the Chechnya War, since fighting in Dagestan, and by counterattacks by Russia, but also just by spread of Salafism.
Some estimates put the Sochi Games at $50 billion. That's in stark contrast to Putin's own estimations of some sort of a more modest sum of $12 billion. But either way, that cash has brought about a vast transformation in Sochi. But at what cost to the local population and the environment?
That's right. Now, and it's important to understand the geography. If you know Vancouver and Whistler, for instance, you know that it was a sort of similar case. Whistler, where a lot of the Olympics were held last time, is quite far from Vancouver, the official Olympic city. This is a similar case where you have Sochi, which is the host city, and then you have Krasnaya Polyana, which is a mountain village a good hour away from Sochi, at least with traffic. And Sochi itself has been a resort since the Russians were there. Stalin was a big proponent of Sochi for rejuvenating the Russian people. It's subtropical. It's where people go on beach vacations. The mountains right above there, Krasnaya Polyana, had a couple tiny lifts, nothing. And it's Krasnaya Polyana that has seen the biggest transformation. Then they've made an event site out of scratch for some of the other things involving stadiums just south of Sochi in an area called Adler. And that is a wetland that's just been totally knocked out to put up stadiums and other housing. There are tons of stories. There's one neighborhood I visited where they've actually been dumping a lot of the waste from the construction, so, you know, lots of fill dirt and whatnot. And activists believe that this caused some slumping. So there's been a sort of landslide underneath these homes, and all of them are now shifting on their foundations. So it's like a hall of mirrors. And when you walk down the street, you see all these buildings halfway, you know, tilted away to the left. It's a bunch of pieces, one after another. And people are still living in them because they have no place to go, and the authorities don't believe that the Olympics had anything to do with this landslide. And that's one case. And then, of course, tons of people were just kicked out of their homes and not given much recourse.
Not for some time has a statesman been so closely linked with the Winter Games, the Olympic Games. And President Putin has been intrinsically linked and has put his political reputation and his legacy on the line here.
Yeah, well, that's what I mainly went to Sochi to investigate, was how is this sort of a mirror of Putin, not how this is happening. So I think it says a lot about how he does things. For instance, Sochi being subtropical, there was real danger that it would run out of snow. When I was there, there wasn't enough snow. They've been spending tons of money to stockpile snow under tarps. You've probably seen, get special snowmakers. I think there will be snow. I think the force of the Russian state will make things like that happen. The infrastructure is impressive, and I think it will get done, and I think it's been done by breaking a lot of eggs. I think that's Putin's legacy. He's pushed for big things. His friends have gotten rich, and the little people have been pushed out of the way all the way through. I mean, the games have only been a starker version of that.
Journalist and author Mackenzie Funk. Now, from one Olympic city to a host city of the future, Rio, where a gardening project called Green My Favela is transforming rundown and neglected land into green spaces and gardens. The project has been running for the past 2 years and has built gardens in some of Rio's largest shanty towns. FSN's George Powell went along to meet the Green My Favela team as they went to work in a vegetable garden in the Manguinos.
Green My Favela is a gardening project that reclaims and transforms degraded land in some of Rio de Janeiro's largest and most neglected favelas. The Green My Favela team have made more than 10 gardens over the past 2 years, ranging from vegetable gardens, therapeutic gardens, and even medicinal gardens. They work with volunteers and favela residents and are currently working on a vegetable garden in the Manguinos Favela in Rio's northern zone. Leah Recco is the director of Green My Favela, and I've come along to meet her and the half dozen volunteers who are braving the 40 degree heat to clear rubbish, pull out weeds, and plant seeds. Before anything can be planted, the first job for Leah and her team is to clear away literally tons of rubbish, because although favelas like Manguinos have seen improvements under the government's pacification program, many still lack basic services like regular rubbish collection. With over 44,000 people living in Manguinos alone, uncollected trash quickly builds up. Leah's background as an artist has led her to work in marginalized communities all over the world, and I asked her to give me a quick rundown of what Green My Favela is all about.
This is a space for residents, by residents, and we look at ourselves as a support network to get projects going and to open people up to new possibilities, because there isn't any economy that's readily available in the favelas, other perhaps than drug trafficking, and so this is a really good way to introduce a multi-generational project where people rely on each other to do a form of knowledge exchange that's very hands-on, and they all learn from each other in the process and take ownership of the project.
The project relies on minimal funding so that once a garden is up and running, the residents can keep things going as cheaply as possible. In order to keep costs down, Green My Favela uses volunteers, both from the community and further afield. Chris Burden has been living in Rio for the past 12 years and has experience working in the city's favelas.
It's a pretty deprived community, so my expectations weren't particularly high. So I was quite surprised and impressed by the structure they've got here, with these lovely, you know, well-constructed raised flower beds filled with soil from elsewhere. And the fact, the story of the project, that it was formerly a rubbish dump inhabited by crack addicts, and they managed somehow to transform it into, you know, a functioning vegetable garden in the middle of what was one of the most deprived favelas in Rio. So that's quite impressive, really.
While the garden itself seems to be coming along nicely, with 15 or so different vegetables growing in the 48 flower beds, the setting and conditions make for hard work, with an open sewer flowing along one side and piles of burning rubbish filling the air with thick, acrid smoke. Local volunteer Anderson, however, assures me that things were much worse before.
Aqui, antes de ter essas hortas, era muito lixo.
Before this garden, the area was full of trash, and when it rained, the whole place would flood with dirty water, filling up people's houses. It was like a pigsty. We looked like a bunch of pigs rolling around in the mud, with rats, cockroaches, and scorpions crawling everywhere. It's much better now. I got involved with the project because I thought it sounded interesting, and I wanted to learn about plants and how to help the environment.
Vamos estudar mais.
With well over 1 million people living in Rio's 700 or so favelas, there's certainly no end in sight for Green My Favela. However, Leah and her team will no doubt continue to spread their green dream one garden at a time. George Powell for Feature Story News in Rio.
And that's the Tuesday edition of FSN Reports. You can tell us what you think of the programme by emailing us reports@featurestory.com. You can also follow us on Twitter. We're there at Feature Story. And coming up on Wednesday, we look at the impact of President Obama's State of the Union address. That's Wednesday, but for now, I'm Kevin McAleese in Washington, alongside producer Simon Marks and Rebecca Foster on the Bulletin Desk. For everyone with Feature Story news everywhere, have a great evening. And who better than the man once called America's tuning fork, Pete Seeger, to play us out?
All over this land, I'd hammer out danger, I'd hammer out a warning, I'd hammer out love between my brothers and my sisters, all over this land. If I had a bell,